I'm Rob Watts. I'm CEO of Ecotech International. In a former life, I founded the LEED Green Building Rating System and was heavily involved with the growth of the U.S. Green Building Council for about 15 years at the beginning. I shouldn't be called the moderator. I should be called the immoderator. But what I'm going to do is mostly get out of the way, ask pointed questions when necessary, and let the conversation begin. But what I want to do is I want everybody to do this, put on silent or off your phones. If I don't see it in your hand, I'm assuming you've either not done it or have trouble speaking English. Okay. So having done that, we have a really good group of people, most of whom I have the pleasure of to have known for quite some time, and I can attest that they are quite expert in the field of green buildings and integrated solar technology. So I think we're going to have a really good conversation today, and we've been asked to state whether we believe there is a market in BIPV or not, and where we think that's going to go. And so I think I'm just going to sort of arbitrarily start to my far right with Fiona Cousins. Fiona, why don't you just introduce yourself quickly and, you know, put your opinion out about, you know, what the market is and what your, you know, quick experience is in a minute or so, and then we'll just sort of work our way across.
Whole minute, huh? So my name is Fiona Cousins. I'm a principal at ARUP. My background is in engineering design, mechanical engineering design. My exposure to this subject is through projects that I have worked on that have PV of some sort. They are all integrated to a greater or lesser extent. And it is actually true that my last five major projects have all had PV on them, and I don't think that's because they all come to me because that's what they want. I think that's because of an accident of the clients and things that have happened. So I think that we're seeing more and more photovoltaic on and integrated with buildings. And I think that that's likely to continue into the future as the prices look like they're coming down.
Good morning. My name is Udi Paret, head of marketing and business development in Pythagoras Solar. My background actually is engineering and education, but I spent about 20 years in computer communication. I had the privilege of being part of a company that really was developing the early Ethernet technology way back then, in which we all live by today and create a huge change in the world that we live and work in. We can see the change. When I was introduced to the founding members of Pythagoras Solar about 5 years ago, I was intrigued not just by the caliber of the folks, but also by the vision and the combination of the technology, because I could see the change that this kind of technology and vision can create in the way we live and work in buildings. And that's a short answer to your question, Rob, about where I believe and where I see this industry going and the impact it's going to create on this huge footprint of building and energy.
Okay, Greg. Good morning. I'm Gregory Kish, a principal with Kish and Cathcart Architects. We're in Brooklyn. For the 27 plus years of my practice, I've been involved with PV and BIPV. I'm actually very lucky that some of the very first projects I did involved the solar industry in its relatively early stages. And it was immediately obvious to me as an architect that here you have a product which is typically more or less a piece of laminated glass, and that is a material that we use quite a lot to build buildings with. If you look out the window, you'll see many square kilometers of it actually scattered throughout the city. So it seemed to me that there was a synergy between the two, or ought to be. And as a result of that, I've been looking from the beginning to find ways to integrate PV into my architectural projects. So I've done BIPV projects, some of the earliest in the world, and we continue to do them. I would say, though, despite the fact that you know, I did my first real BIPV building back in 1990, that the BIPV market doesn't really exist yet, not at all in the way that it that it should and will, I think. I think that the BIPV market actually will be one of the largest segments of the PV industry. In fact, one of the largest, ultimately one of the largest sources of energy that we have. And the reason for that is that although historically BIPV has been actually an expensive technology, one that is significantly more or much more expensive than conventional PV, that the potential is there for BIPV to be much less expensive than conventional ground-mounted PV. And so that's really the goal that I think the industry needs to move to. It's not there yet, but it will get there. And when that happens, I think it's inevitable. BIPV will be an enormous market.
Okay. Jose.
I'm Jose Alcala. I'm with ELAB. We're a consulting firm that does renewable energy, mostly solar and wind, and mostly in building integration. Got into the business by accident. I'm trained as an architect. I have an architectural practice as well. And people started coming to me asking, how do I make this interesting into a building? How do I integrate it into a building architecturally? They were less concerned with the technical application of the wiring and so forth. They just wanted it to look architectural. And that's basically what we based our firm on, is allowing architects to have their vision and to make it work too. It's not just an aesthetic application. I do think that there's a BIPV market, otherwise I wouldn't be in business. But what I have seen is that we do a heck of a lot more feasibility studies these days than we do actual projects. A lot of people are interested, but not a lot of people pull the trigger on it. But what we are seeing is that architects are determined to make it happen, from my perspective. They're determined to have this as a material that they want to work with, and they want to be the first ones to do it.
Okay. So if we've read our intro and the agenda, we see some fairly significant and impressive growth opportunities in building integrated PV. Going from about 200, I think that can't be 0.2 megawatts, I'd probably say 200 megawatts, to about 5.4 gig. I've seen 700 to 2.5 gig, but no matter how you, gigawatts of install capacity, and depending upon whether you define a solar panel that's bolted to the side of a building as BI or building A, BA, a building applied PV, BA PV, and we can have a discussion about, does it matter? Clearly we are poised at a fairly significant growth moment in the industry. A lot of barriers are coming down. In New York City, for example, Zone Green was just adopted, allows a lot of the height restrictions and protrusion restrictions to be relaxed, some of which has been a barrier to photovoltaic installations in New York City. There are about 35 states with some form of solar access law. 43 states now allow net metering, and so slowly but surely the code and economic barriers seem to be diminishing. And maybe this is the choir, maybe everybody is like, why aren't we doing BIPV? But I'm going to start back with Jose and work back this way. What are if you had to give the top three barriers to exploiting the potential that Greg asserts is going to be one of, if not the largest, energy resources. What do you see the principal barriers? And then maybe on the next round we'll go, what would you do to knock them down?
Do you want to get these people to introduce themselves?
Oh, yeah. We're the only important people in this room. But we'll give you guys a chance to. Okay, sorry. That's right. I was supposed to have you guys go around. Thanks, Fiona.
I'm Danny Gold with AECOM. We're large engineering services company in the solar and wind space. We do sort of EPC, typically utility scale and roofs for school districts or hospitals, so something like that.
I'm Andrea Ricarte. I'm Agrion's business development manager.
Mick Davis. I'm with Agrion. I work with businesses and organizations to help them generate leads and show off their intellectual capital.
Hi, I'm Ron Javer with McLaren Engineering, full-service construction industry engineering consulting firm. We are very much involved in solar and have a dedicated team to that, and I'll leave it to one of my colleagues here who's the head of that.
Hi, I'm Pamela. I'm a community manager at Agrion, and I work on the solar and wind aspects and renewable energy financing aspects of our program.
Okay, nice to meet you. I'm Jung Ho Yoon, came from Korea, so 14 hours. Actually, I know this event a few days ago by internet search, but luckily is that I'm doing some VIP project. Actually, I just started last year a government project, the definition of a VIP system in Korea. So actually, our government set the regular price for the VIP system and the regular PV systems, but there is no definitions, some confusions. So I think this is very similar situation with the US and Korea at the early stage. So anyway, it's a good chance to get the very informative information from this event. Thank you so much.
I'm Robert Politzer. I'm president and founder of Green Street, and we do green building. We've been doing it for 15 years. We also are doing solar, commercial solar, as well as starting to develop some of our own projects, and we're opening up, very excited to say, we're opening up a green building center in Manhattan here. So hopefully you'll be hearing more about that as we open the doors.
I'm Greg Kelly. I'm also with McLaren Engineering. We do some research into building integrated solar with Columbia University. We also do some traditional panel, you know, mounted system research. We do a lot of structural engineering for actual installations, be they utility scale or building mounted. A lot of stuff in New York is building mounted, doing utility scale elsewhere like Florida and things. And doing a lot of parking lot covers is a big thing. And anywhere where there's a lot, you know, parking lot, Jersey and Maryland, we're seeing a lot of that there. One thing I would say is we have seen a lot of these feasibility evaluation type studies coming out this year. It just seems to be a trend, so I wouldn't be worried too much that it's, you know, something that you're seeing in IPV. It seems to be just where the industry is, the construction industry, and I think AECOM would probably say that they've seen the same thing this year.
Great. Hello. My name's Oliver Kohler. I've been in the PV industry for over 10 years, mainly on the manufacturing side. I've worked with BP Solar and with SunPower. Of the last 6 years, and I'm currently Vice President of Sales Marketing for BIPV Inc., so I thought this was a good conference to come to. But we're mainly focused on residential, so integrating into residential roofs, and companies actually based out in California. I've opened the New York office, and but we're looking at residential integrated products in mainly the Southwest and the Northeast near term. And right now, we have the only integrated product out there. A lot of people have left the market, such as SunTech and even SunPower. One of the last things I did when I was there was mix their product called SunTile because it was just too low volume. But I think there is, the major players are moving out because they're in an existential fight out there in the market. There's going to be a huge shakeout. And so they're lopping off things that aren't absolutely critical. But we think there's still very much a market there, especially, but you need to get through the channel to the end customers, because if a lot of times the end customers do want it, but it's not often presented to them. And the costs also have to come down. I mean, one problem with this residential building integrated has been that it's always been way too expensive. It's made sense in the new home construction market, but not so much in retrofit.
That's a great way to kick off our barriers conversation. So, Jose, back to you.
I would say the top three are labor, building codes, and ignorance. Mm-hmm. And with ignorance, I'd like to say that with ignorance comes a poor understanding of the economics of it. And that has to do something with the way developers look at projects as opposed to the way economists look at projects. From the code standpoint, I would say working mostly in the New York area, that's constantly a barrier that we have to bump up against. And that also kind of flops its way into the ignorance part. We're always educating. I think the core part of our business is to educate first and get everybody's fears, you know, relaxed a bit. Labor is a real problem, and labor is a problem because nobody knows what to do with it. Nobody knows who to claim it, and everybody's trying to fight to get it. And sometimes people get it who are not qualified to get it. Mm-hmm. So when you have glass, you have electrical, you have, you know, glazing structural, you have ornamental metals, you've got a lot of people trying to get it. We did one project where, believe it or not, sheet metal workers got it. Don't ask me why, don't ask me how. They did an okay job. But yeah, we constantly have that challenge, especially in union jobs,
right.
When everybody wants a piece of that pie.
Great. Thanks. Greg, what do you think?
Well, I guess
I'd feel free to agree or, you know, it's okay.
Watch it.
Okay. I agree. I wouldn't put them in that order, I guess.
But don't be afraid of disagreeing.
Okay. Well, I don't disagree yet, but I'll make a point of it soon. I think the number one problem is, I wouldn't say technological is the right word, industrial or sort of industry wide. That is that, I think we need to talk actually more about the definition of BIPV, BAPV, and so on. But for now, I'll just say that, you know, from the point of view of certainly, you know, commercial, institutional architecture, and so on, what's really critical is that BIPV products be available sort of on the same terms as building products, you know, that they are building products. So if you buy a piece of solar panel that you're going to use as a cladding material or somehow in some other role in a building, that it be available on the same basis as any other type of building material is, which is basically...
By available. What do you say that it... I understand the words, but I don't understand what you're trying to say.
Well, that you can buy a piece of a BIPV panel that is any size and shape that you want within some reasonable range,
okay.
And that the cost of it is going to be more or less the same per square foot or per square meter as the standard PV or BIPV panel. That's what makes it like the, you know, the building industry thinks in terms of dollars per square foot. Mm-hmm. The PV industry thinks in terms of dollars per watt. And those two have some very complicated and sometimes contradictory relationships. So, and the fact is that certainly almost all commercial architecture is based on entirely customizable products. So you do not build buildings out of standard products. You know, you design a building and you don't have to worry about ordering a window from a catalog that's precisely 4 feet wide or a piece of cladding material that's 6 feet wide. You know, you know you can get what you want. So to deliver that, the PV industry has to customize the standard panels, which themselves are not typically usable in a building. And it is technically possible to customize them. There is an industry of sort of second-tier players who do that, but the cost of customizing is extremely high. I mean, it seems to me that it would be sort of legitimately could be 20%, 50% more than a conventional PV panel, but typically a custom PV panel is 5 times or 7 times or 10 times the cost of a standard.
So cost would be your number two barrier.
Well, they're related.
Design.
Yes. Yeah, they're related. So the number two barrier is code, I guess, agreeing with Jose, although I would say maybe I'll focus my ire, at least in the U.S., more specifically on UL, which is a very, very cumbersome certification process that is required at this point for any unique electrical component that you get. So if you design a building like the one across the street with a BIPV facade, you would probably have, you know, 80 different PV facade panels in it. And at this point, you'll have to get 80 separate UL listings for them. And that's a slow and expensive process. So I think that's the biggest sort of code-related barrier that exists. And my third one would be awareness. Education, just that, and aspiration, maybe, that I think people are not aware of what is possible, what the potential of BIPV is, and therefore they don't really try for it, or they don't try for it early enough in the process of doing a building to be able to optimize the use of PV.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Udi, kicking it over to you, what are your top three?
So I'll actually build off Greg's and Jose's points, but try and put them in three bigger buckets, so to speak. The first one is economics, and some of the points you guys made before related to the cost, price, the fact that there are unions involved in jobs in large metropolitan, etc. At the end of the day, in order to get to the mass market, the economics have to work. And the economics needs to be such that the ROI is clear and feasible, that the incremental cost, out-of-pocket cost in the project would be palatable for the building owner, and it's financeable. And if you achieve that, I think one big barrier is going to be removed. The other one is associated with risks that the building owner and the project team sees through the implementation. Again, some of the points you brought up are related to those risks, whether this is coming, this is going to be available, this is going to be available in different kind of shapes and forms, and whether UL is going to be a barrier or not going to be a barrier, is it going to work, what happened, who's standing, who's providing the warranties, you know, basically design out the risks for the building owner and the project team. So, and each one of them has different point of view. Now, the architect might have different point of view. And if you can drive the economic, show the economic to work, and mitigate those risks for the project team, I think those barriers are going to be removed and allow a more easy of adoption. The third one actually relates to the architect. It's kind of funny that, you know, both Greg, you are the architect, and Jose is an architect, didn't mention it. But what we're hearing a lot, there is the aesthetic point of view, and people that have done BAPV projects, the few, and I'm talking about the commercial buildings, actually did it with a great intention to make a statement and show this is PV. However, when we are talking with hundreds of architects looking at variety of projects, they actually would like eventually to have the clear glass view, glass facades, and make it as simple and adaptable into their current design processes and the look and feel of glass. So the more flexibility you can provide to the architect in terms of aesthetical appeal, I think that would remove another big barrier in terms of implementation.
Okay, so kicking it to you, Fiona.
So at the risk of being a little bit repetitive, I think the first barrier is actually money, and it's can you afford it on the project? It always costs more than whatever it was you were going to use instead, or not having anything at all, depending on the situation. And not everybody is happy to look at paybacks at all, but even if they are, they find that the paybacks are just too long. So there's a barrier that's around cost. Some of my clients more recently have started suggesting that it would be better to get the PV through a power purchase agreement so that there's no capital cost outlay for them. But there's another barrier right there, and that's not so easy to do. There are not that many firms in the PPA market who are prepared to put PV on other buildings, especially if it wants to be building integrated. So the second thing that I think people get very worried about is, if, especially with building integrated, less so with building applied, is how long does this stuff last? What's it going to look like in 5 years' time? What's it going to look like in 10 years' time? And will the electrical output still be the same? Because you're not necessarily sure what you're buying. And some of the, you know, the products have existed for a long time. The ones that are longest standing, of course, are in space, where they're subject to completely different sets of conditions to the ones on Earth. Nobody's quite sure what happens if you put this thing out there for 30 or 40 years. And there are elements of the facades that of regular buildings that need to last for 30 or 40 years. Nobody guarantees them past 20, but they're quite often still there 40 or 50 years later. I think we can see that looking out the window. and then the third barrier is this question of applicability and how you manage to get competing bids for things. So this is really what Greg said about having panels that can be any size and shape you want. You need to be able to have the panels any size and shape you want, and you need to be able to get three bids for each of them. And then you need to be able to get them UL listed. And the combination of those things together, the fact that there's not really enough competition in the market, everything needs to be custom work in a building. and that you then have to get every one of these things UL listed is a huge, huge barrier. And I speak from the position of a project where we put the PV on, we installed it, we finished, we got all the way to temporary certificate of occupancy, and we couldn't get the temporary certificate of occupancy if the panels were wired in because they didn't have the UL listing. It took another 6 months for us actually to be able to connect the panels to, this is silly. We missed a whole summer of production because we couldn't get the UL rating. We only had one panel type. It shouldn't have been hard, but it just took forever. So those are the three: money, maintenance, and this inability to do custom.
Okay. So I'm going to put on my immoderator hat and suggest that at least right now, I don't ever see photovoltaics being, quote, cost effective. And it's not the fault of photovoltaics. Okay, it's the fault of an 18th century economic concept that is just completely applicable to 21st century reality. And I'll just illustrate this by holding up these two green rectangles. Can anybody, I'll give my whole wallet away. Don't worry, I've done this a million times. I know it's not going to be done. Can anybody give me two physical objective reasons why this green rectangle is worth 1/20th of this green rectangle? Or put another way, why is this green rectangle worth 20 times more than this? Physical, objective, chemistry, biology, physics reasons.
It would be heavier to carry it in gold ounces.
Okay. Why is this green rectangle worth 20 gold ounces and this one one? Is there something physical and objective about this green rectangle that makes it worth 20 ounces versus this one?
No, there's no intrinsic value.
Okay.
A bigger picture of the president.
Okay, that could be. All right, that's one. Can anybody give me another one?
It says 20.
It does say 20. Okay, what does that mean?
It's 20 times the value. It's
20 times
I'll
the
answer
one.
The question. It means that we believe this is going to give us 20 times as much stuff. Okay, there's nothing physical or inherent about this having more value than that. Okay, now let's turn that cost equation. Are there any physical and objective reasons why solar is more expensive than coal, oil, or gas? Okay, we all agree that the production of electricity, by and large, from these things is largely benign. We all agree that the resource is significantly larger. It's distributed fairly. It doesn't kill people or very few people taking it, right? Some birds might get it from wind, right? But are there any, and we also agree that all these fossil fuels are objectively, physically, chemically really bad for us as human beings. They produce good services. But as a fuel, are there any physical, objective reasons why solar and wind are more expensive than renewables?
Is it unfair to blame the whole thing on Dick Cheney?
Sure, why not?
It's probably more unfair, but probably more accurate to blame it on Adam Smith. Okay, but
maybe
the point I want to say, sorry, go ahead.
Maybe there are smaller economies of scale you just can't use their resources.
Okay, so because we're poisoning ourselves more, it should be less expensive? Is that the logic there?
I would say it's the privatization of the profits and the publicizing of the costs.
Okay, there we go. That's intrinsic in what I'll call capitalist economics. Okay, that is hardwired. You cannot, the whole crux of capitalist economics is that the impact of the transaction is separate. It's just that is sun revolves around earth, earth revolves around sun, paradigmatic, hardwired in. And now what we've got to do is we've got to put the earth where it belongs, which is revolving around the sun, not the other way around, right? So all we have to do is change the way we think, and all of a sudden, solar becomes economic. But under what I call egonomics, I don't think it ever will be. I don't see it happening. Go ahead, Robert, and then Fiona.
I do want to add that I think in many ways one of the many problems we have with the existing energy infrastructure that we have, especially with regards to fossil fuels. But it's true that fossil fuels in general are extraordinary sources of power. They're extraordinarily, you know, there's a reason why petroleum has dominated the planet. You know, there's such an extraordinary energy density, you know, hundreds of millions of years to make this stuff, you know. I mean, it's very, 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 very good at doing what it does in a limited framework. And that's another thing that we're fighting against. I mean, you know, it's, you know, at this point in time, there's been many, many hundreds of years of research and development. They know how to extract the stuff. They know how to refine it. It's
sure.
It's easy to go, you know, drive up, and there's a whole infrastructure with gasoline and with, you know, fuel oils and whatever. So we're fighting on many different fronts, along with the externalized costs that are not being integrated or internalized into the actual cost.
No balance. Yeah.
So there's many elements. This is a fight on many fronts, I think.
Well, and I mean, I think too, though, that the problem maybe isn't so intractable, because I would think that a couple of things: the rising cost of energy might actually drive people, just by greed, to do the right thing. The costs, I think, now are partially obscured by the fact that we have a very short-term horizon on our analysis that we typically do, and that's a cultural problem that we could do to change. But even that problem isn't fundamental to capitalism. It's fundamental to the version of capitalism that we're practicing right now, which is, again, a short-term horizon. So I don't know if it's so intractable. I like to think of energy prices as rising and solving this problem.
I know Fiona wants to eviscerate this argument. I could tell.
No, I don't actually have anything to say specifically on this one. I think that it is possible that it could become economic, actually, over time. I think that if fossil fuel prices rise, which they sometimes do, the paybacks become much, much more straightforward. And as the PV panel costs go down, actually that becomes makes things much easier too. It is already at least twice as easy as it was 10 years ago to get a payback that actually makes sense on a project in a sunny place. Mm-hmm. But you know, how much longer is it going to take, right?
Yep. Okay.
Okay. I want to. I think that I hope you don't really believe your statement that it will never be economical. I mean, in fact, PV is entirely economical right now and has been for some time in certain applications. I mean, for ages, it's been much cheaper than many forms of off-grid energy, and today and for some time, it is quite a bit cheaper than expensive retail grid energy. So, you know, it is already economical, and the trend is very clear. It's becoming more and more so.
I'm going to violently agree. I throw that out. I usually throw that out there without the asterisk, because the asterisk is, in order to get PV at the scale, scope, and speed we need to avoid a serious ass kicking by Mother Nature, and that's the asterisk right now. And you know, under egonomics, we are headed straight for the cliff. And you know, it doesn't mean we'll die after we go off it, but there's nothing to prevent us right now. There's no way the market's going to be able to adopt, because right now, in my opinion, PV ought to be close to free, and anybody who puts in anything but building integrated PV ought to be, you know, paving their, you know, cladding their building in gold for all the economic sense of things. So.
Well, I think you're right about the pace and the timing and all this. BIPV can be, I think, a major part of the solution to this problem, though. I mean, if you look across the street at the facade of that building over there, I could design you a building right now that has a BIPV facade that costs much less than that one does. And so it's, you know, given the inevitable adaptation of the industry to make it easier and easier for that to happen, that sort of no-brainer kind of economic decision will become more and more obvious mm-hmm. to more and more people.
Yeah, it's certainly clear that because PV has a payback. You calculate the payback, whereas you never calculate the payback for a granite facade.
Because well, that's the thing. I mean, 99% of stuff in buildings is either because it's required by code or the owner wants it, and never shall a cost effectiveness calculation, you know, sully the fact that they want that sandstone marble, you know, put your expensive material there. I mean, the fact that they apply that discipline to other things, it's just, excuse me, show me the payback on that and justify the expense, and then I'll show you mine.
Right. I think one great takeaway, Rob, is that you would now accept $1 instead of $20 when we need to pay you. That's a great revelation right there. But to the points here, I agree completely with Greg here. BIPV today is economically viable. ROIs, we can show ROIs on commercial buildings anywhere between 3 to 5 years here in the U.S. Still, we need to work through the barriers we talked about before, but the economics already working.
So in New York City, we've got a lot of shading. We've got, reasonable solar climate, but there's a decent amount of clouds. So what are the technical issues? Where would you put PV in New York? And again, Jose, I'm going to kick it off to you because you've been thoughtful and quiet.
Mm-hmm. Could you repeat the question?
Greg was saying that this east-facing facade mm-hmm. would be, would it be given, potential shading and, the way the sun runs and how much, because a lot of it does have to do with, those kind of physical realities in a dense urban environment. And so, where would you put PVs in a dense urban environment to maximize output and benefits and sort of weighing all those things?
Yeah, I think an urban environment is a completely different question than a suburban or a rural environment. We have to deal with the surfaces that are available. And in a dense environment like this, we have very few surfaces, most of them being vertical, very few horizontal surfaces are usually loaded with mechanical. But there's still quite a lot of facade available if it's done strategic. I think the idea that you must have a perfect scenario every single time is the wrong approach. You do the best you can with what you have, and sometimes an east and west facade does work if you design it accordingly. You can't just do what you would do in a south facade. The same is true if you do something in a horizontal environment. Building integration, the important part about building integration is that you can't just look at it as solar harvesting. You also have to look at it as, building performance. And how are you shading the building so that you don't have heat gain? How are you addressing other kinds of issues? You can recapture that heat behind the panel and recirculate it into the building. There are other ways to do it. The difficult problem with the economic part is that how do you convince your client of all of those factors? And do you have enough information to make a true financial matrix of this thing? And it's not an easy thing to do. We find ourselves doing much more in economics than we do in design. We spend a lot of time doing these very elaborate spreadsheets that we had to learn just to be able to convince our client that this is the right idea. And
we should ask them for the spreadsheets that they used to calculate the payback on their proposed cladding system, and you'll just put in your values there.
Exactly.
But that suggests maybe a venue that we as the professionals in the industry needs to take. I mean, I agree. We see too the need and the requirements to elaborate on economics and all the different parameters. One venue that we find very effective is actually just leveraging on the segments that the industry is already doing. So they are doing energy performance analysis of buildings. If we can separate the segments and work through the energy performance side and then the PV generation side and help them just combine them, I think that helps kind of work them through the process. Again,
so,
it's not
so
quite
instead
there.
Of GAAP, you need GASP, generally accepted solar accounting practices.
Otherwise it's a very uphill battle to as you described it, Jose. It's a very elaborative process. So we're trying to work with the project teams to take them through the steps that they're already kind of used to, and the tools they are used to use in order to get to the results that they are showing. To your point, the end of the day, nobody is doing ROI on a facade like that over there, but they do go through the engineering, the energy engineering analysis of the building. They do that. So if we're using the same tools, I think working through the increments can help get them there.
What I'm seeing, I'm sorry.
On the topic of tools, I was just going to ask if anyone's familiar with the energy budget at risk methodology that Jerry Jackson at Texas A&M has developed. It's a version of the budget at risk, which is the standard practice, and it allows for an explicit quantification of the risk associated with the energy prices and lets you come up with probabilistic answers, giving you confidence levels for your different levels of return on investment. And so it's a way, if you have a sophisticated client that's used to, you know, sophisticated financial analysis, it's the language they speak, and it's very powerful. It's also a public domain tool that you can get, you know, on the internet. It's something that I, you know, like to steer my clients to. We do engineering, not financing, but if you can lead them in the right direction, sometimes you can make the project go when it might die a premature death for lack of good analysis.
We're seeing much more success in this recession as far as convincing clients, because the new developer is actually a developer owner. They're not flipping after 5 years. So they don't, the flipper doesn't really care what it's going to do in 20 years. So they just want the capital cost to be as low as possible.
Is anybody aware of any, I mean, now that we're starting to get a little bit of market data on, you know, Energy Star and LEED certification and, you know, increases in NOI and increases in asset value rentals, blah, blah, blah. Anything similar for solar projects that we've seen that, you know, do submarket comparables, solar versus non-solar, that can indicate whether... I mean, we all sort of assert that, you know, solar is sexy, solar is sizzle, solar is, you know, wow, and people want it. And it's true. You're not going to put, you know, a COP7 chiller on your annual report. You're going to put your windmill, your, you know, or your, you know, PV program. But I'm just curious whether enough projects are out there to have done that kind of, you know, actuarial evaluation that anybody knows about.
I think we're seeing that in the university scenarios, but mm-hmm. It's not coming into the... into our practice. The interesting fact here is that we're getting more and more companies that, or departments, marketing departments coming to us rather than the facilities people and asking these same questions. And they have marketing money to go to PV as opposed to cap to
sort of building.
It's a very interesting way.
This is the way demand side management started with utilities. It was a marketing, you know, public relations thing, and then they realize, oh, we really have an asset here. Maybe right. We ought to start capitalizing it. So, Greg, where would you, I mean, would you seriously, what would you do to this Eastern facade to, you know, make it a viable BIPV application?
Well, you know, I think it's impossible to generalize. Every project is unique. If we were to take this admittedly oversimplified scenario that you could have yourself an energy generating facade for less money than that one, then I'd put it everywhere, you know, just on that simplistic level, because it's costing you less money or no more money, and any production you get out of it has value. In reality, it's not going to be like that in most cases, but the fact is that you can get significant output from actually most building facades or other surfaces. I mean, interestingly, you get in the middle of the summer, you get more output from a north-facing vertical PV than from a south-facing vertical PV. Also, you know, it's people often don't study the relationship between PV output and electrical rates, time of day, seasonal rates, and so on. So, you know, it may be that the orientation that gives you the most kilowatt hours per year, in fact, I think it's very likely the orientation that gives you the most kilowatt hours per year does not save you the most dollars per year in terms of your electrical bill. So it's a very complicated...
Could you amplify on that just a second?
Yeah, I mean... most likely, I mean, an optimal orientation in this climate would be a south-facing panel tilted around 30 degrees or so, but a more horizontal panel will get you more, save you more money on your energy, because you'll be saving more higher summer electrical rates. If you have time of day metering, you may find that if you're restricted to, say, vertical surfaces, that probably a somewhat west-facing vertical surface will save you more money because of time of day rates, you know, which peak a little bit later in the day. So it's, you know, it's a complicated subject, and you've got to look at it, you know, on a case-by-case basis.
How long would it take? I mean, what you sort of, I got this picture of almost like a, you know, one of those Energy Star labels or NFRC labels, you know, Fenestration Rating Council labels, where, you know, a building has its kind of, you know, solar thermometer, solar gauge, and it would talk about what the, you know, opportunity is for solar given, you know, how much physical shading there is and, you know, orientation and, you know, combination of vertical and horizontal facade. I mean, how much work would it take to go through and sort of create, I'll call it a solar viability map for, you know, New York City?
Well, I mean, we actually already do that. I think that it ought to be standard practice on an individual building basis to just simply do an insulation analysis of the surfaces of your buildable area, and you'll know what the available resource is there. I mean, I think also that we sometimes get hung up in the sort of specific orientation of individual PVs and so on, and where do we put them on the building, without realizing that there's another way to look at it, that the site overall has a certain total insulation that it receives over the course of the year, and that that, you know, you can get the same, you know, you might get the same output from a vertical, entirely covering a vertical surface with PVs as you would with a getting tilted, freestanding or separated panels mounted off the side of it, but not as frequently, you know. So even though individually these might produce more, you have more area in the aggregate, and you're limited ultimately by the total insulation that falls on this building. So if in fact it's cheaper to integrate the PV into the vertical surface, you get less per square foot of the PV material, but in the end you're better off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
this is one of the more difficult things to communicate to people, isn't it? That they sometimes, and sometimes to have more PV working less hard is actually better overall than to have less PV working really hard and optimally in terms of the amount of energy produced over the course of the year. It's sometimes the best thing to do is to put the PV in a fairly inefficient organization for the PV itself. But I've worked with so many people who have, they start off by not believing it, and then they work through the math, and work through the math, and work through the math some more, and the conclusion is always the same. You should maximize the amount you have rather than maximize the effect.
Sometimes you get circuitry issues. I mean, I know that depending upon how a module is circuited, you know, small shading can eliminate the output of the entire circuit. I mean, are we? That should be an engineering and manufacturing question that's being looked at. I mean, I don't know.
Certainly microinverters are going to help that
a
lot.
Yeah.
And you're seeing those really take off on the residential side. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I was going to ask you guys on what new technologies are you leveraging in the building integrated space between thin film, microinverters, or those type of.
Before we do that, I wanted to ask Udi a question. I mean, I think Greg mentioned it earlier about, and maybe Jose as well, about, you know, the building performance related issue of the technology, that, you know, it's designed well to generate PV and not much else. And one of the things I really like about the Pythagoras technology is that it has thermal and solar gain performance that far exceeds pretty much any other window product on the market, in addition to the solar gain. I mean, how much of the building performance versus the solar generation, you know, aspect of the Pythagoras technology do you see contributing to its, 3 to 5 year paybacks.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the question because I was actually about to bring this up, and Greg made this point before. And it's related also to this definition of BIPV, but at the end of the day, if done correctly, the BIPV has to be a standard building material that has multiple functions in that particular building material. It's not just PV for generation. It is first and utmost part of the building scheme and has to deliver a highly effective energy efficient building material. And if we're talking about windows, then it has to have the low U value, it has to have a very low solar heat gain coefficient, it has to allow for high visual transmittance, it has to really break through the abilities to provide an energy efficient scheme of the building to first and utmost reduce the energy footprint of that building. Because this is by far, I think, to your question, by far the most important element in order to be able to really design it into buildings in a large and take advantage of this huge space. There's a lot of effort going into this space anyway, regardless of BIPV, you know, energy efficient windows, anywhere from the low E coated windows that became standard, double pane window, all the way to more dynamic type of solutions, and that's the right place to go. Absolutely.
And yet here we are with single pane metal frame windows in New York City in, you know,
exactly.
2013 or 12.
And then if the whole idea of the economic value is really to combine the two together, so allowing the building architect and the engineering company to take it and use it now in larger space as part of their more efficient scheme, first and utmost, and then take advantage on this huge space, this is, and turn those cost elements into generating assets, really generating assets literally, both electricity and $20 bills. And the higher power density, the better. But then this whole question about whether it's a 5% efficient module efficiency or 9%, it becomes really starting to become marginal. Of course, the higher the better. You want to generate as much as possible. But then this question and all this question of orientation becomes less important, less critical. Now you can use it first and utmost as part of an energy efficient facade, and at the same time generate the high power density. You've got the best of all worlds.
So I want to do a quick lightning round starting here and going this way. So BIPV, so ugly that only a mother could love it, or you know the new aesthetic going forward, or something in between?
I personally would say the new aesthetic.
And introduce yourself.
Colin Tuohy, I'm with Pavilion. And I would say it's the new aesthetic, and a big piece of it, I think, that there are often people who want solar and want to hide it, but it seems in the construction industry that people want the opposite. They don't want to hide it. They want it to be visual. So while they want to be able to see out their windows, they do want to show off that they're doing something solar. They don't want to just be a regular building. So I think it's the next step is this thing.
And just Colin's company has about his stuff is mad sexy in terms of aesthetics.
Yeah, we do tensile structure design and manufacturing.
Okay. So ugly or not?
I think somewhere in between. You know, I think I think building integrated has a certain cachet. People are interested in it. I think very often the marketing department or someone wants it somewhere where it's visual. And the uncomfortable thing with building applied is often it's not visible at all. And so you have some monitor in the front lobby and it's like, ho-hum, you know. So people want to see it somehow. So I think there is an aspect, and certainly I think Europe is here. It's proven its success here and there. But it doesn't happen a lot because the costs are very, very much.
Yeah. Okay. Hold on. This is lightning round.
I think we can make it cool, especially in residential applications. I don't know who decided that asphalt shingles look good. I don't think anyone has. So I think we can make it the future, no problem.
I think it's in the eyes of the beholder, and I think most people are average, and I think most people's aesthetics are trained for conventional looks. So I mean, most of us are early adopters here in this room, so to us it might look beautiful, but I think to the average person it's new and different and odd.
And that can be good or bad.
So, yeah.
Ugly or beautiful?
next time, yeah.
Do you think building photovoltaics are beautiful or ugly?
Definitely, I agree that it should be beautiful, and it's really beautiful. It's the most important thing these days.
Good, thank you. Okay.
I think the shingles help, so I'm with sexy, sleek, and nice aesthetic.
I think they're beautifully functional, although don't think I'm quite ready to put one on my home yet.
Okay. I think they're beautiful because they spell progress, but then again, I think a windmill on the horizon is beautiful, and there's certainly thousands of people who disagree with me.
Yep.
I think beautiful for newer buildings, especially if from what you're saying that the new developer is the developer owner, because there's something beautiful about the building performance as well.
Yeah, modern new buildings, sure. I would not like to see one of the Rockefeller buildings with BIPV or BAPV.
If I could just add to that.
Absolutely.
In New Jersey, they implemented that solar panel on every telephone pole scenario. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
Yeah.
You can have your own opinions about whether it's beautiful or not beautiful. But they had the same discussion in the 50s when TV antennas were going up. They had the same discussion in the 80s when satellite dishes were going up. And now they're having the same discussion. It's like, oh my God, these ugly things are everywhere. And I think we're eventually going to forget that they're there. We're going to ignore them, just like the cell phone towers. That doesn't say that it gets us off the hook. They're still kind of weird. And they're not properly integrated into the infrastructure of a city. So I think when somebody cracks that one and makes that the telephone pole and the PV integrated together, then we're going
to
have something.
It seems to me that this gets exactly to what Greg was saying about, you know, right now photovoltaics are trying to drive the building rather than the building driving the photovoltaics. And until you can sort of get that ability to really design, you know, the cell, you know, it's like you can have any color you want as long as it's black, right? And that, I think that is one of the things that limits it.
Yeah, but that's being removed too. I mean, look at the innovations coming from a variety of companies today that really gives gives architects now a whole set of different looks and feels and functions. I you know, not to say that it's as simple as choosing glass off the, you know, the beam systems. But it's getting there very quickly, mm-hmm. very quickly. And, you know, you look at the facade across the street. I don't know if anybody around this table would say this is a beautiful facade. It's definitely not homogeneous.
I would.
You would? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's about some of the architecture
you know
in New York City.
No, Greg, you know what? This is great, because if you would, then you shouldn't have any problem with BIPV on facades, because it would look very much heterogeneous as this facade looks.
Well, not necessarily. You know, I mean, I think if you, I won't say if, I'll say when BIPV really takes its proper place in the world's infrastructure, it's going to be everywhere. And it's no longer, I mean, right now we're in a transitional period, you know, and there's a question in my mind is how architecture, especially, and other forms of infrastructure will respond to this. I mean, this is one of the most seismic shifts in architecture, you know, since other transformative technologies like the elevator or the steel frame or whatever, I would say, where you have, you know, a building facade's job until now, from the beginning of history, has been to keep the weather out and let some light and view in. If you add to that generating energy, I mean, that's a pretty big shift in its program and function. And I don't think that we know what that effect will be on architecture in the long run. I think that certainly in urban environments, we don't have the luxury of having a lot of form making associated with solar, really, because, you know, it's a very dense sort of environment and we're going to be stuck with fundamentally vertical surfaces and so on. But there will be a profound effect. What it is, I don't know. And I think that in the end, it's not going to be a look at me kind of technology, because it will be ubiquitous and it has to, by definition, recede into the background or we'll all go crazy.
So Fiona, given that, you know, at least in the U.S. and Europe, the bulk of the built environment for the foreseeable future is existing. This seems to be, you know, a retrofit situation. I mean, how many of your projects are retrofits as opposed to new builds. What are the challenges you see in a retrofit versus a new build type of project?
So almost all my projects are new builds. That's kind of the nature of the work that I do. So, but I agree that much of this is going to come with building reskinning and working out how to do some of those things. And that's something that I think we're still just getting our heads around. There are so many, you know, a building comes to the end of the facade's life, and there is always a question, should we change the building completely, knock it down and start over, or should we reskin it? And the economics don't always work in favor of the reskinning, although they probably should from a facade, from a sustainability, from an invested cost, from a time to construct point of view, they probably almost always should work in favor of reskinning. Once we start seeing that, I think when you put a different curtain wall on the building, you can put a different curtain wall on that has a building integrated photovoltaic technology within it. And I think that, you know, I have this idea that the world is turning blue because that's the color that PV panels tend to be, but actually that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. I think that some of the best BIPV applications are actually the thin films integrated into the glass, where you get dual uses, shading and power generation. You use it instead of frit, used instead of shading devices. I think those are actually some of the places that we might see it and actually see a little bit more flexibility in the aesthetics that are open to the architects. Mm-hmm.
We've done a few studies where architects do come to us and developers where everybody's seeing the facades aging now. And the majority of buildings that need this new facade is a pretty large number of buildings that are in the next 10
all
years.
All that crap that was built in the 80s.
Yeah. In the next 10 years, you're going to see a lot of facades changing out. Hoffman La Roche over in New Jersey changed their facade out. They didn't go PV, damn it. But we did a feasibility on a project right here in Lower Manhattan for a south facade, all glass. They were going to replace a
was that an economic situation with the Hoffman project? Because, I mean, you know, somebody mentioned PPA and other kinds of financing mechanisms that, you know, could take a lot of these large investments off the books. And does that seem to be, you know, will BIPV be saved by sort of financial mechanisms or?
Well, in Hoffman La Roche, I wasn't involved in it, but I do understand it was not an economic problem. It was a visual one. Mm-hmm. They had a certain look that they wanted to adhere to, and it was more of a branding idea. That PV just wasn't able to solve that problem for them, but that's that issue. The one that we did here in New York in Lower Manhattan, we were able to do a very large PV facade there, and have a 5-year payback, which is that's very fast for a BIPV. It's true BIPV, and of course that had incentives involved, and that was a couple years ago when the incentives were better. The model is probably a little different now, but the cost of panels have gone down, too.
Yeah, the rates have gone to the toilet in New Jersey.
Right. Yeah, the rates are really bad. But it's doable. Unfortunately, the developer who was looking at this went bankrupt, and Woody and I talked about this just earlier, went bankrupt, and now there's a new owner interested, too, so Woody and I are going to talk about this later.
So, Greg, what fraction of your projects is new versus adaptive reuse? What do you see the opportunities and challenges of sort of the adaptive reuse area?
Well, all of my current projects are new, and certainly that does make it vastly easier to talk about BIPV and so on. I mean, I think that reskinning buildings with curtain walls, it ought to be a kind of a no-brainer for BIPV, and there should be a lot of that. What will be trickier is other situations or more historic contexts, urban contexts, where you really probably don't want to see a lot of PV or glass, you know. So then it will be a question of, can you do it at all? If so, can you hide it somehow, you know? And there are ways that can be done, but it'll probably be smaller and more expensive opportunities in that sort of case. But, you know, with the demographics of the world, there's going to be another 2.3-ish billion people by 2050, all of them urban. It's going to require an awful lot of new buildings to be built. So, I mean, really with our existing infrastructure is a serious problem, but there's a
clearly in developing countries. Yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. So how is, I mean, in terms of the BIPV that AECOM does, you know, is it you know, parking lot and kind of, you know, more utility scale stuff, or in terms of your BIPV related things, is it new build, is it existing, what is the distribution?
We haven't done any BIPV yet, so right now we're doing a new terminal for one of the major U.S. airports. So our lead architect for the project, our head architect for the project, wants to do BIPV. The energy group are trying to help them do it. We're coming to a problem there where it's not really economics or visual, but it's labor is becoming the big issue. So, and I wanted to ask you guys in the QA, because, you know, it's the glazers versus the electrical.
And the QA is starting now, by the way. It sort of started at the beginning, but we're about 15, 20 minutes out of the...
That's been the biggest headache for us, was, you know, these two different labor groups. And so, you know, that's kind of been the pushback from the airport from the beginning, as who does what. And I'm not an architect, so I was interested to hear from you guys. Is this the only product where you have that sort of issue? Are there not other building products that kind of, you know, straddle between two different labor groups? Is this really a new thing? And can it not be mitigated? But, you know, to answer your question, no, we aren't really doing so much BIPV yet. But, you know, we having lots of clients like that, we expect it to be big.
What about the McLaren guys? Do you guys...
Well, we do the light version, which is the solar carports and things, which, I mean, certainly are legitimate BIPV. It's just the building has a very basic function, which is to, you know, keep the rain off and the snow off. So we do a lot of that. That's really popular, and I hope continue to be a big trend. If you got a parking lot, why not? Now, when it comes to, you know, putting BIPV on existing buildings, I don't see a lot of the utility there, because the redundancy elimination doesn't really happen. You already have a roof, you already have a facade, unless you're actually replacing all the curtain wall. We looked at that on the UN and a massive curtain wall replacement, but the aesthetics killed it, as they would for many, many projects in New York. The building integrated stuff that we do, which is true building integrated, is still in the research level, and it's exciting stuff. But it's got to be, you know, 3 years from being at market minimum. So building integrated is technology, from a technology standpoint, I think very challenging. But it's even more challenging from a standpoint of the trades and UL, and it's, you know.
Well, I'd like to get at the trades thing a little bit, because I mean, I remember, you know, a few years ago in Philadelphia, there was if you'll pardon my French, a big pissing match over waterless urinals, right? I use that very pointedly. And if only the enviros and the unions got together and said, look, you give us waterless urinals and we'll give you gray water reuse. And all of a sudden, the unions would get 60% more work and the enviros would get three times the water savings. You know, there was a classic win-win there if people could only just take a little step back and not focus on that one thing, but look at the bigger issue of water savings, water efficiency, and all of a sudden, my God, there's a huge opportunity there, and we can work together to get what both parties want. Right, so I don't know enough about the nuances of who's fighting whom over what to understand what's going on here, but I'd love any illumination that people could shed on that issue.
Well, I think the first thing that I would guess is that, like a lot of modern building products, union areas are slow to adopt. We see most of the stuff being adopted other places outside of New York first, a lot of times because of the union. Now, you see a lot of like prototype projects in New York because of the high profile and everything, but then a lot of times the adoption will actually go elsewhere because the unions are a big barrier. But they're a barrier in this market only. So what happens afterwards, obviously, is once the trend is established and there is market and there's scale, then it comes to New York, and the unions, like you said, they're kind of forced to the table by the economic pressures. I like your idea of getting them to the table early, though, in a collaborative way.
Well, I'm thinking, I'm about to put on my John Lennon hat here. I mean, you know, I mean, couldn't there be some sort of cross-cutting force where you've got representation of all the potential folks in there, and it's that group that, you know, together does
the mayor's green building task force, right? For that. I'm a member of the task force, and that's its mission, is to help get all those people together and take down the barriers. That's the stated mission of the task force. So I would say that's the forum.
How's
for
it going so far?
Well, the work's done and it's been implemented. It's fantastic. What we now need to do is move into round two of it, which is again, you know, like they do with the lead every 3 years, you do your revamps. We need to, you know, set up for the next one. So that would be a great topic for the next one and perhaps could be a central topic.
I would just want to clarify on the labor thing. I just want to make a distinction between the union labor issue, which is they're champions to a trade, and it's the trade that's really the issue, not the unions themselves. Mm-hmm. I just want to make that clear.
Sure.
Because we're finding the same thing in non-union jobs where a trade wants to claim it when the trade really has no business claiming it. They're in the wrong place or at the wrong time. For us, we have a tendency of, on the design side, trying to solve that problem before it gets to the bid side. And the way we try to do it is try to move things toward unified systems, have glaziers do it off-site, have it crane it in. You know, maybe there's a union guy on the factory floor plugging a couple things there. They're fine. Get shipped onto the site, gets craned up. In a week, it's up. And then an electrician has, you know, some nice environment. They're dry. They're not hanging off the side of a building, and they're plugging stuff in. That's what electricians like to do. They don't like to hang off the side of a building. Glaziers do that. Ornamental metal guys do that. But when the electricians are claiming the job and winning it, they've exposed themselves now to not being able to satisfy the job properly or on time. And that's where really the conflicts happen. It's not that they can't do it, it's that they shouldn't do it.
So just to amplify on Jose's point, I think while this good and very essential work that needs to be done at the almost political level, so to speak, I think, to your point, Jose, I think on us as the designers and manufacturers, there's a lot of responsibility to simplify the process, just like you described, and create those distinctions, which would eliminate a lot of these trade wars when it comes to the actual projects.
So we've got one, two questions.
Yeah, quick
question. We've got about 10 minutes.
Question on this topic: what is kind of the cost differential between the electrician trade versus the glazer trade? And I think you mentioned that one problem is just they bite off and they can't really do it properly. But what is the cost side of it? I think the cost comes in the time that's involved. Electricians spend usually more time if they're hanging stuff, you know, on the outside of a building, as opposed to an iron worker or a glazier that they're very well equipped. They've been doing it for a long time. They know how to get things up there with cranes and done. They don't dilly-dally. Electricians do work in a different kind of mindset, a different way.
Mm-hmm. Just going to add, I think the operative word here is integration. And, you know, one of my frustrations in general, trying to build green for 15 years, is that we 98% of our projects we work on are disintegrated design, bid, build processes, and yet, you know, building integrated PV is such an integrated item. I mean, from a design perspective, let alone from a construction perspective. So, you know, how can we really push this building integrated PV field along when we're still working with the bigger problem of this process that's so disintegrated? This is like a main mission of mine right now, is to be working towards integrated project delivery and making that be a value-added proposition that's recognizable in the marketplace. But I think that's one of the biggest problems of all. I think, you know, I've been on a number of projects where so many really smart green technology and other building applications were not implemented because they were either suggested or recommended by some consultant in some point down the road after much of the design had already taken place, or there was an owner making it, you know, looking at it from a strictly separate perspective. That's going to be an added cost instead of looking at a whole systems design approach. I think the process we're working under in general is one of the biggest problems of all to integrating.
So Fiona, you've been in this business for a long time. You know, are you seeing more integration, or what would you do to get at some of the points that Robert's brought up here?
I think that the biggest barrier to the actual integration of PV into the facade is this performance issue. How long is it going to last, and is it going to last as long as the alternatives would last? So, I mean, that's kind of where I see it. It's not so much in can you do it, or it's more in should you do it for some of the
integration. I have my own researchers telling me that, yeah. that the problem is the longevity of the PV.
But we're talking about the longevity of PV and performance. Is this within the question of the economics? Because if
some of the early thin film looked really awful in a really short period of time.
So that's aesthetic.
The oil can, so that disintegrated mm-hmm. somehow, and the result of that was that those buildings needed replacing much more quickly than they otherwise would have done. And the biggest element in a life cycle cost analysis is the replacement cost.
Absolutely.
How long is this thing going to last? How long right. can you amortize it over? And so there is a piece of PV technology that worked really badly. So it has a reputation in the market for not being that good and that long lasting.
We know that that infant mortality can doom a technology
and
for
it's,
a long time.
It's not really a problem with some of the. It's not really a problem with the polycrystalline. It is a problem. Was a problem with thin film technologies. The thin film technologies have moved on, but none of them have been around for long enough that you can actually say with true guarantee it's going to last for 20 years. The manufacturers, many of them, are very, very confident that it will. The derating of the electrical output won't be that great, but there are very few people who are actually prepared to say, yes, I'm going to integrate this, I'm going to put it into my facade, I'm going to put it into this thing that's supposed to last for 20 years and that I hope will last for 50, because I just can't afford for it to go wrong in this place. I think it's more of a risk analysis on the integration than otherwise. So yeah. I don't think that it's a question of design build or design build or that kind of integration of the design technology. I think the real reason people don't want to integrate it is for longevity.
On that topic for standard crystalline PV, when you're looking at a 50-year building life, I mean, you kind of expect that eventually that PV maybe stops working at year 30 to 40, somewhere in there. And is that, I mean, how do the building owners deal with that?
If it stops working at year 30, nobody really cares, right? You do your cost-benefit analysis on 20 years.
Yeah, as long as it still looks good.
As long as it still looks good, it's okay at that point. You choose to replace it or not replace it, as long as you've sized your electrical equipment large enough, your incoming, which you have because you have to size it for when the sun's not shining. So
there's no
real issue with it not working, but there's a huge issue with it looking bad.
You don't want to manage the expectation with it not working, though. You have to.
The derate is actually pretty slow. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that it continues to be pretty slow. I don't think it does this. I don't think the chemistry or the physics of the panel manufacturer is such that you do this and then you do this. I think it probably just does this until eventually it's not worth
it. And if we dovetail this with the economic part that we spoke about earlier, this need or this push, this desire to make it as cheap as possible. That can be a dangerous thing if we're not careful, because what we're seeing is that in need of bringing costs down, we're starting to take risks as far as quality, where it's getting manufactured, the product longevity, and these other issues are starting to become clear to us now. We're starting to get inferior product from Asia that we see more and more, and it's a very upsetting.
So you think the tariff is a good thing?
I do think it's a good thing. I think it's going to make it more competitive. And that's not to say that the Asian market can't produce high-quality product, but it's far too tempting to get the cheapest product, you know, because you're trying to do a megawatt and you want to go cheap. There was this one project that I visited in Spain. This is just kind of where this thing happens. A big field install, 3 megawatt. It wasn't producing as expected. In some of the strings were producing in poor ways. They started looking at it, testing, and they couldn't figure it out. They visually looked at the panels, and they saw that some cells were actually photographs of cells that were laminated into the panel.
Wow. There's no issue on longevity. Wow.
That's a way to bring the price down. Great way to bring the price down.
So image is everything, right?
And let me do another lightning round after this, going around, you know, tariff, good thing, bad thing. Don't know. Okay, but go ahead, finish. Go ahead.
So they went bottom, you know, bottom cost, cheapest cost that they could find. It was a huge boatload that came from China. They went after them. You know, they gave them the 20-year warranty. They don't exist anymore. They unloaded product and disappeared. That was their whole business plan. So we have to be careful about just going cheap, because it might come back to bite us. You know, quality over cost.
Okay. So, bad thing.
Okay, tariffs are bad.
Good thing.
Good thing.
Unsure.
Okay. Tariffs, good thing, bad thing, unsure. Solar panel.
I'm sorry?
The Commerce Department just stuck about a 30% tariff on imported solar panels from various Asian countries. Good thing, bad thing, don't know.
I just heard about that this morning. We talked about that. It seems like the Chinese are going to kill us, is basically the way things are going to economically.
Do you think the tariff is a good thing or a bad thing?
I think we need to be competitive, any way, shape, or form.
Good thing, bad thing?
I think in general it's bad, but in this case it's good.
Okay.
Actually, I think it is not good, because actually in Korea there are so many companies. So for instance, 3 years ago, some company want to make a business in Korea, they have to register in government some agents. So two or 3 years ago, the number of company was just 100, between 100 and 200. But last 3 years, the number was increased to the almost 4,000. So most of Korean companies involved in the PV or BIPV business. But last year, quite big PV company was bankrupt because of the cost of PV module. A lot of cheap Chinese module was imported to the market was very not clear. Mm-hmm. So most of Korean company had very hard time to endure this situation, even if now. Mm-hmm. But we are very we are very sure the PV system and BIPV system go get increased. So anyway, the cheap sudden decrease of the PV module is abnormal situation. So it's break the market, normal market. So I think it's not a good case, good situation.
Well, we all know that the Chinese government is hugely subsidizing their industry, and this is intended to address that to some degree. The hard thing is that there is a real buzz in the conventional solar industry, especially in the design and construction part of that, about dropping costs. And I think it's getting out there. Wow, solar's really dropping in costs, and a big part of it is because of the drop in solar panel costs. And that has helped to spur a much larger solar design and installation industry, which in my view is really where the future is in this country, not in conventional panel manufacturing. I think the only panel manufacturing that's ever going to take root in this country will have to be some kind of innovative products that come out of MIT or whatever, and you can't use, you know, some kind of, right. But a conventional panel, I don't think there's any place for it in this country. So I think it's a bad thing, and it's gonna harm the design and installation side of the business.
I agree. I think that we need, though, we probably need it to save the guys that are currently in the market in the U.S. from just total disaster, right? So what I would wish for, and I don't know if this has actually happened, is that tariff phased out? Or because I worry about creating permanent aberrations in the market, which would kill our competitiveness internationally, because nobody cares about the tariff except for here in the U.S. So. Does anyone know? Is that tariff phased out, or is that tariff 30% permanent?
Nobody knows. It's a preliminary ruling. The final ruling will come in the fall, and then they'll kind of tell you how it phases out. Now, if the tire thing ruling that was similar that came out, I think, half a year ago, it's going to go down pretty drastically. It may maybe be there for two, 3 years at most.
Right, and I think that would be very positive. That's exactly what the industry needs, you know, to like you said, fight that basically unfair condition that the Chinese government's created.
Okay, got two more yes, no, and then we've got a couple of panelists that have flights and other urgent matters to attend to, but then we can, we'll wrap up the session, and then we'll be able to do a little networking right. And discussion afterwards. So.
Okay, so real quick, tariff, I think it's mixed. I think long-term, making solar cells is not that complicated, and if
if chips are made mostly in Asia, solar cells and panels will be mostly made wherever they can cheapest to be made. More differentiated technologies will still be here. A lot of the thin films are in the U.S. because they're hard to make. Now, I think, so in principle, I think the tariff is good in sending a message that's saying, look, you can't just flagrantly subsidize things to win markets. But I think, unfortunately, it's not, it maybe puts some of the U.S. guys on life support for a few years, but it's just going to help them move their stuff to Asia, which maybe is okay.
Just going to what, sorry?
Just going to help them move their stuff to Asia, because, you know, long term, they can't survive here with the cost, unless they're really making a differentiated product.
Yeah, I would say it's a bad thing. It's delaying the inevitable.
Can I modify my unsure real quick?
It's complicated.
It's an unequivocal bad, I think, because it doesn't solve the underlying issue that as Americans we gravitate towards low quality products, and our economy is based and has been for a while on high volume, low life. So things don't last long. We don't build things to last. So we're going to gravitate towards the cheapest upfront thing. And I think that, you know, it comes back to you showing your the 20 and the 1. The fact is our economic mentality is a little backwards and our perception of value is backwards. And until we solve that, artificially playing with our international trade laws isn't going to really help that underlying flaw.
Would you like an answer to the same question?
I'm sorry?
Are you looking for the answer to the
I
question?
Am.
Oh, I think
no one's exempt from lightning round.
I think it's a bad thing. I think it's a legitimate negotiating tactic, but it's a bad thing.
Bad thing? Agree with Fiona for exactly the same reason.
Yeah. I think it's a bad thing because anything that makes solar more expensive is not good.
And I don't know, actually, and mainly because I say that because I don't really know the economics of the Chinese producers. I mean, if they're actually making money at these prices, then so be it. You know, that's the real. If it's actually, you know, conscious dumping to, you know, destroy other competitors, then, you know.
God knows no American company has ever done.
Yeah, well, right.
It's very mixed. Right. They're basically getting very low or no interest loans, free land, things like that. So their costs.
Yeah. Well,
and all that stuff happens here, too. I mean, you know, believe me, they lure manufacturers with, you know, tax breaks, with, you know, free to cheap land.
We're starting the discussion with the oil companies. That's exactly what's happening in the States.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you guys have been great, and panelists, audience, we're at the 11:30-ish mark, and so I wanted to thank you all for sharing your time and your expertise with us, and thank you all for coming out and sharing, and I think we've got...